The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Hello and welcome to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show here on KPCG 101.3 on the FM dial and at kpcg.fm. This is Richard Palmer standing in for today for Mr. Stephen Flurry, your regular host. And usually I start by looking over some of the significant headlines from the news. But today, unfortunately, there is really only one headline. The terrorist attacks in Brussels. 34 people were killed and over 200 wounded in an attack on the airport there and a railway station. Now, details of what exactly happened, how they got away with it, how many people were involved, etc., are still coming out. So instead, I thought I'd talk today at first about some of the major effects that this attack is going to have and cover some of the, or read some quotes from some of the best articles and analysis on what this attack means. And the first really important thing to take notice of is that these attacks aren't going away. And this is going to be the big lesson that hits many people in Europe this week. You know, Europe has had attacks before. There was the July 7th bombing in London in 2005. There was Madrid 2004. But after those London bombings, Western Europe has really been, by and large, free of these kind of massive attacks. But now the tempo has really picked up. You know, we had Charlie Hebdo in Paris last year in, I think that was January. Then there was the massive attacks in Paris last November. And now this. And so Europeans are starting to realize this is happening every few months. This isn't going away. Unless we make some big changes, we are going to be seeing these news stories about these attacks in modern, Western, normally very safe cities very regularly. And that's a big change for Europe. A society changing development, a civilization changing development, and the amount of leeway that politicians have to bury their heads in their sand in the sand and pretend this is all going away is quickly disappearing. So Europe has a major, major problem with radical Islam, and it is not going away anytime soon. We've talked about Europe's Muslim project, Europe's Muslim problems here before at the Trumpet, and Daniel Benjamin had a really interesting article on Politico this morning, where he brings out a couple of fascinating statistics that demonstrate quite clearly the problem that Europe has here. He compares the number of Muslims who have travelled to fight for ISIS, for the Islamic State, that have travelled to the Islamic State from Belgium, to the number that have travelled to fight ISIS from the United States. And just from tiny Belgium, more Muslims have gone to fight for ISIS than from all over the US. And in fact, it's almost twice as many Belgian Muslims have gone to fight as American Muslims. And that's not just because Belgium is closer to Syria. You know, you're almost going to if you're traveling even from Belgium, you're almost certainly going to have to fly over to Turkey. Whether you're coming from Belgium or the US, the journey's not that different, not too much easier. And I doubt you're seeing a drop in the number coming from America just because of a few hours flying time. There is a genuine problem here. And another indication of how widespread and how deep Europe's Muslim problem goes and the problem with radical Islam comes from the fact that it's apparently very easy for these terrorists to hide out in Belgium, as many of you are familiar with. Salah Abdeslam, it's a hard name to pronounce, but he was the mastermind behind the November Paris attacks, and he was arrested last week in Brussels. But the fact that he could be hiding right at the heart of Europe for so long, it was about 4 months, points to the scale of the problem. The Economist, they had an article, I think it was this morning, writing the fact that Salah Abdeslam could remain on the run, hidden in central Brussels from November until March, suggests that families, friends and neighbours served as support networks for him and failed to tip off the police. So this isn't one radical terrorist. He had plenty of people that he could turn to for help, for sanctuary. You know, there's a whole society there that were willing to hide him. Well, maybe society is too big of a word, community maybe as well, but there was at least a sizable group that was willing to hide him and keep this person who was responsible for the deaths of over 100 people. And they were willing to hide him from the police to keep him alive, etc. And so going back to that political article, another surprising stat that points to the scale of this problem that he brings out is that since 9/11, there have been four big terrorist attacks in Europe: Madrid, London, Paris, and now Brussels, and they've killed a total of 426 people. Now, when you look at terrorist attacks in the United States since that time, so that's not including 9/11, but that does include Fort Hood, the Boston Marathon, San Bernardino, Islamic terrorists in the United States have killed 45 people. So Islamic terrorists have killed 10 times more people in Europe than they have in the United States over that period. Now, that's not to say the US is safe. It's not, but instead it points to that the threat is even greater in Europe than it is within any threat that exists there within the United States. And Lily Bayer wrote at Geopolitical Futures, "Attacks like those in Brussels today, especially on soft targets like large, unprotected public transport centres, are likely the new normal for Europe." The new normal. These aren't going to go away. In fact, people are saying Europeans are going to have to get used to this. Terrorist experts are saying that the Belgium attacks are evidence that more are on the way. Tagspiel, they wrote yesterday on evidence that the Islamic State have a cell that's still on the loose within Germany. And the Telegraph wrote, "The coordinated attacks on Brussels' airport and metro system show Islamic State-inspired terrorists have become embedded in Europe with the capacity to become operational within days," said anti-terrorist experts on Tuesday. So think about what is involved in stopping these attacks. Imagine trying to set up airport-style security for every railway station, every shopping mall, every stadium, every city square in Europe. You know, there are over 2,500 railway stations just in the UK. So protecting all of those soft targets just is not possible. So that's the first big takeaway from this attack. Europe is vulnerable. It has a huge problem with radical Islam. These kind of attacks are the new normal, as Lily Bayer put it. And the second takeaway that I'd like to address is that this was going to have a major impact on European unity. And this is something that we'll come back to in the second half of this program as well. But in attacking Brussels, ISIS was attacking the EU. And George Friedman, he wrote on Geopolitical Futures, "Islamic State, IS, tends to be more strategic than other terror groups and has the ability to coordinate attacks. Therefore, why would they choose Belgium and Turkey for their attacks?" And he goes on to talk a bit about those terrorist attacks in Turkey from earlier this week. We'll stay focused on Belgium today. And he continues, "Belgium is not only one of the countries of Europe's core, as is France, but is also in some sense the capital of Europe. Brussels is the headquarters of the European Union Secretariat. It is also near the headquarters of NATO. By striking Brussels, IS was striking at Europe's core. IS has come to see Europe as an enemy, not only because it sees it as Christian, but also because it sees it as hostile." So as we talked about earlier, more attacks are coming, but this is also a direct attack on the EU, on the European Union. Stratfor also noticed it, and they wrote that the March 22 attacks targeted EU institutions and Belgium. So they're going straight for the EU. And this is going to have a major impact. That fact, and then combined that it's another terrorist attack, that's going to have a big impact on Europe. And Vox actually had what I thought was probably the best article so far on this, on these terrorist attacks. That was called, "The Brussels Attacks Are a Profound Threat to the European Project." And again, they make the same point that this is targeted at Europe. They write, "One of the bombs detonated at a metro station close to the heart of the city's European quarter, a symbolic blow to the project of European unity and integration. But the attacks on commuter destinations for an international community of European officials, following Brussels-based attacks on Paris, are also a practical challenge for European integration." And towards the end of that article, they really made some great points. I'll quote a bit from that. And they write, "International terrorism arising from Belgium is, in a way, a national security equivalent of the economic crisis that emanated from Greece in past years. They are the result of Europe currently sitting in an unsustainable midpoint in the process of integration. One possible path forward would be for authorities in France and Germany to conclude that since their national governments have no capacity to address social and economic challenges in Belgium, they need the ability to seal themselves off from problems arriving in Belgium. That would mean the return of border controls and passport checks so that Belgium-based plotters can no longer gain easy access to foreign cities. And then they go on to talk about the troubles in Schengen and this open border zone has had since the Paris attacks, and that EU nations are already drawing away from this. But then they go on to write, but the other possibility would be to follow in the footsteps of the reaction to the debt crisis, where problems caused by partial integration have tended to lead to even deeper integration within the European Union and European Central Bank. They go on, in this case, that would entail some centralization of law enforcement powers through the creation of a centralized police agency or a formalized process of state-to-state collaboration. Whatever the details, the point would be that if people can hop on a train in Brussels and arrive unimpeded, or France or Germany a few hours later, then French and German citizens need equal trust in Belgian law enforcement as they have in their own domestic agencies. And then their conclusion is really excellent. Here's just their last concluding sentence. But time and time again over the decades, Europe has faced decision points where it either needs to go forward to more integration or backwards to less. And the ultimate decision has almost always been in favour of more integration in the end. That's spot on. And that is where these Paris attacks and where these Brussels attacks are now leading. Now, core Europe, the Schengen zone, has open borders so terrorists can cross borders easily. And Belgium has some serious, serious problems. You know, they recently set the record for the longest amount of time without a government. There are questions as to whether the nation of Belgium is viable in the long term. You know, they have one now, but this long-term deadlock and tension between the Dutch-speaking and French-speaking parts of the countries are causing some really major problems. And firstly, it's led to a very inefficient police force. In London, you have the Metropolitan Police, one police department. In New York, you have the NYPD, New York Police Department. But Brussels has six separate police departments for this one city. It used to have 19. Each police department has to report to several different mayors all within this one city. And so this causes all kinds of practical problems when it comes to solving these terror attacks. And at the same time, Belgium's problems make it very hard to integrate Muslims. You know, how are you going to make a Muslim proud to be Belgium and give him an alternative Belgian identity instead of a radical Islamic identity when many Belgians don't want their country to exist and don't want to be Belgian? And so this Greece analogy that Vox used is a really good one. You know, Greece had problems with its economy, and their shared currency, the fact that they shared the euro with the rest of Europe, that made it everybody else in Europe's problem too. But the rest of Europe had no direct control over Greece's economy. So they shared the problems, but they could not impose any or could not affect any solution. So Greece could destroy Europe's economy, and there was nothing the rest of Europe could do about it. And this problem and this halfway house between division and integration caused the whole Greek crisis to blow up. And it's still not over yet, but it has already caused Germany to find a way to exert significant control over Greece's economy. And really, that's the only way that you can have any kind of unity like this. And this is what you have in Belgium. The same thing, but just with national security. Belgium's problems can cause terrorist attacks in other countries, like we saw in Paris in November, or on EU institutions. Open borders mean terrorists can travel from Brussels into France, into Germany, into anywhere within the Schengen zone very easily. But then the French or the German police and security authorities have no direct say in Belgian policing. There's nothing they can do to fix the problems in Belgium's government. And so this same dichotomy, this same partial unity, partial division that we saw in the Greek crisis is pushing Europe to some shared solution, some shared police force, maybe a European equivalent of the FBI, something with major resources that can track terrorists across multiple countries and then has the jurisdiction to go in and get them in multiple different countries. And that's not something that's going to come about right away because of this Brussels attack. But as we covered at the start, these attacks will keep on coming. The options are either falling apart or coming together. And so as these attacks keep coming, it's going to keep pushing Europe to come together. And it will, in covered by this Europe coming together, it will also have an external effect. You know, these attacks are being sponsored by the Middle East. They're being driven by turmoil in the Middle East. Solving them will require tougher policing at home and more outside involvement. And so this is going to push Europe to increase its military integration and effectiveness. And that's something that we'll talk about in the second segment today. But the final point that I'd like to discuss just at the start is that these attacks are going to force a fundamental change in the nature of European society. Now, Europe is already in huge, huge turmoil. That's just from the immigration crisis and the aftermath of the Paris attacks. Spiegel had an excellent article just a few weeks ago ahead in the run-up to the local elections that Germany had a few Sundays ago. And it was called The Third Republic, Germany Enters a Dangerous New Political Era. And it said stability used to define Germany's political system, but the refugee crisis has fundamentally changed the party's landscape. And it went on to talk about, is Germany's political system, the entire way of doing things that has governed Germany since World War II, is that now breaking down? And that is the context that these Belgian terrorist attacks are hitting. And these attacks, I think most people would have suspected these attacks are going to keep coming. They're going to be a monthly, or well, not monthly, but every few month occurrence. These Belgian attacks really drive that home. That they're going to keep coming, that this is a repeat problem. It's not just a one-off. And this is the landscape that that's hitting Germany, that it's hitting Europe. The Spiegel article talks about it. It says 7 or 8 months ago, Germany was a different country than it is today. There were no controversial political issues demanding immediate action, and Chancellor Angela Merkel's leadership was uncontested. It was quiet and comfortable. But then the refugees began streaming into Europe, and the country's sleepy tranquility came to a sudden end. And just as a side note, many, many people, especially on the fringe right, tie these terrorist attacks in with the migration crisis. And rightly so, because a lot of these migrants are homegrown. I believe the majority are homegrown. But the fact that experts that have training that can move and that also often bring weapons can move fairly easily in from the Middle East and travel around, make it much easier to coordinate these homegrown terrorists and make these attacks possible. And there definitely are terrorists coming in and coming across with these migrants. But anyway, back to this Spiegel article. It says, since then, disgusting eruptions of xenophobia have come in quick succession. A right-wing populist party is on its way to holding seats in several parties. And then just further down, they say, does anyone know what is happening? What is wrong with this country? And after those local elections that saw a really astonishing rise of far-right parties, the Süddeutsche Zeitung wrote that the old ways which determine the political landscape of the Federal Republic for decades no longer apply. What was once certain is now uncertain. What was once considered impossible now seems likely. And the Local had an article titled, Why German Politics as We Know It is Crumbling. So people are questioning the political system within Germany, within other European nations. And if populations start to think these terrorist attacks are the new normal, that governments need to take really radical actions, major radical changes to stop these attacks and to fix it, how are voters going to respond to that? What is that going to do to the rise of the far right? What is that going to do to people saying, we don't just need new leaders, we need a new system? It points to dramatic changes that are coming to Europe. And Friedman wrote an article for Stratfor in January last year on the Charlie Hebdo attacks, which I end up quoting quite a lot, when you see these attacks, because it makes some really dramatic, but then also very logical predictions. He talked about how Europe's police forces have no easy way to tell a radical Islam, a radical Muslim from a non-radical Muslim. And you know, we saw that very clearly when it comes to that terrorist Abdul Salam, who was able to, you know, the police knew who they were looking for. They knew what he looked like. They knew who his family was. And they still couldn't find him. How much more does that apply to a Muslim who has become radicalized, who is planning an attack but is unknown to the authorities? So Friedman talks about how it's very hard for Europe's police forces to find these people, and they don't really have a good way of telling the difference between a radical Muslim and a non-radical one. And he writes, French Prime Minister Manuel Valls has called this a war on radical Islam, and he's made similar statements after these Brussels attacks. And then he writes, if only they wore uniforms or bore distinctive birthmarks, then fighting only the radical Islamists would not be a problem. But Valls' distinction notwithstanding, the world can either accept periodic attacks or see the entire Muslim community as a potential threat until proven otherwise. These are terrible choices, but history is full of them. And he goes on to write, it's difficult to imagine another outcome save for another round of ghettoization and deportation. This is repulsive to the European sensibility now, but certainly not alien to European history. Unable to distinguish between radical Muslims from other Muslims, Europe will increasingly and unintentionally move in this direction. We are entering a place that has no solutions. Such a place does have decisions, and all of the choices will be bad. Think of what a change this would mean, a change away from the modern, pluralistic, multicultural Europe that we see today. But as Friedman says, it's hard to imagine any other possible outcome. You know, Europe cannot defend every building. It cannot tell who will kill and who won't. When these attacks continue to come, you'll see people saying, or more and more people, because they're already saying it, but more and more people saying things similar to Donald Trump, that we need to keep the migrants out. But so many of the radical Muslims are already in Europe. And so soon they'll be talking about, we need to do something about the Muslims that are already here. Again, talking about Muslims as a whole, the same way that Donald Trump does and is doing in America. The far right are rising, and mainstream politicians, they're already moving to the right in response to this. One CDU politician from Angela Merkel's own party said that the terrorist attacks yesterday were Merkel's fault for opening the borders. And so that's really strong criticism coming from, again, within Merkel's own party, Ms. Merkel's own party, not from the far right. So this is going to change Europe, and it's a change that goes much deeper than merely developing a pan-European police force. And it's a fundamental change in European society. Now, these attacks alone, they won't do that. But as they continue, they will help usher in a new, very different Europe. Now, we'll have a quick break now, and when we get back, we'll talk about a related story. It's a major, major event in Europe, but has received almost no coverage whatsoever in the English language media. This is Trumpet Hour on KPCG 101.3 on the FM dial. Keep listening. We'll be back in just a couple of minutes.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily. Are we living in the last days? Some dismiss the notion as fanatical, but world leaders and news analysts are issuing warnings that are becoming more and more dire. Could Bible prophecies about the last days actually be accurate? Our brochure can help guide you through the relevant news and history and help you compare these events to what the Bible says. Are we living in the last days? This brochure is available for free right now at thetrumpet.com. From the Philadelphia Church of God campus in Edstone, England, this is the Trumpet Daily Program.
Welcome back to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. We were talking before the break about those awful terrorist attacks in Belgium yesterday and what they mean for Europe. How dramatically they're going to change Europe. How this is a threat directly to the European Union, to European integration, and how they're going to meet that threat. And now we're going to shift gears slightly to talk about a related story. This terrorist attack in Brussels, that's something you'll be able to hear more about on our next program, Trumpet Hour, coming up at the top of the hour. But one of the top things that we tend to talk about on thetrumpet.com in the wake of a terrorist attack like this is how Europe will respond. And the Europeans, they see America retreating from the world. I saw some headlines this morning talking about how Mr. Obama only spoke about these Brussels attacks for 51 seconds, I think it was. There doesn't seem to be, it's not affecting America and the American public or the American leadership anywhere near as deeply as it is affecting the European leadership. And it's becoming increasingly clear now that the Middle East is being left as Europe's problem. America doesn't want to get involved. And so at the Trumpet, we've been forecasting a major military response from Europe, that they'll get more militarily involved in the Middle East. And that's where these attacks are pushing them eventually. But this raises the next question. If Europe's going to get militarily more involved in the Middle East, well, Europe and whose army? Europe isn't exactly renowned at the moment for being a great military power. In just about every major and even minor military engagement they've had in recent times, they've often needed help from the United States, often in logistics and transportation. Well, one way that Europe can greatly increase their military power, is to work together better. Doing this, creating some kind of pan-European military force, they could be a military giant. And there are some really stunning advances going on towards this end in the Netherlands. In a lot of ways, I'm amazed this doesn't make more headlines. It's a little surprising to me that there's not more resistance to these major developments from within the Netherlands. But then it's also very, very rarely, if ever, discussed in the English press, and that is that the Dutch military is being absorbed into the German military. That's really not much of an exaggeration. What's happening over there is that dramatic. And if you've never heard about this before, I think you'll be stunned just how much of their military power the Dutch have handed over to the Germans. And this isn't just a matter for the Dutch and the Germans. German politicians and EU officials are very clear. They see this as a model, a trial balloon, a proof of concept that they can roll out across the whole of the European Union. And as I said, I think it's quite surprising we don't hear more about this. Last summer, for example, even in the West, there were quite a few headlines talking about Germany's taking over Greece because of the power that Germany demonstrated and that Germany had over Greece's economy. And there were quite a few prominent journalists saying, look, Germany is taking over Europe. Well, if taking over a country's economy is a German takeover, then surely Germany gobbling up a country's military, that should be at least just as concerning. At least as big of a deal. And last month, and even in the last few days, there's been some big news on this. So let's take a look at how Germany is eating up the Dutch army. Now, the Dutch army is made up of three brigades, plus various other special forces units and support staff. These three brigades are, there's the 11th Air Mobile Brigade, the 43rd Mechanized Brigade, and the 13th Mechanized Brigade. And it's these three brigades, and plus I said the special forces, and then those all-important logistic and support staff. And the 11th Air Mobile Brigade joined the German army in 2014. And then last Thursday, the 43rd Mechanical Brigade officially joined the German army. Now, those are the official joining ceremonies. It's still going to take a couple of years just to fully move everything over and get it integrated. But this is a major deal, revolutionary events. These Dutch brigades, they aren't just doing training maneuvers with Germany. They're not allying with Germany. They're not even creating a joint Dutch-German brigade. They are actually and literally joining the German army. They're immediately commanded by Dutch officer, but ultimately it's German. They're under a German general. They'll be under German command. The Dutch won't be able to use these forces without German permission. And this is really unprecedented within modern history. In the past, there have been some token gestures like this. There's a joint combined French-German force, for example. But until recently, that had never actually fought together. Every time they went into combat, it split up into its German and to its French units. And these kind of efforts, they've kind of been token gestures. You know, the government says, yeah, we'll form a joint force with some other nations. Stick a few soldiers in it, be good for PR. It helps strengthen communication and relations between the two different armies. But it's mostly a token gesture and also something to help the armies communicate better together. But this is far more than that. The Dutch army has only three brigades, and two of those brigades are now under German command. I think once you include support staff, I doubt that's the majority of their army, but it's certainly a very significant chunk of their army is now under German command. Now, last month, the Dutch German defense minister and the Dutch defense minister and the German defense minister, they put in place efforts to go even further. So they're moving on to naval cooperation now. But why would the Netherlands do this? Why is Germany interested in this? Well, the deal that they came to last month gives a good illustration of the reason. As part of this agreement, the Dutch and the Germans, they will share the Dutch Navy's largest and most expensive ship, the Karel Doorman. And this ship is designed to play a few different roles, but probably most importantly, it can transport and land troops. And it can land heavy equipment. It has space for helicopters, so it's kind of an amphibious assault ship. Now, until recently, the German military was designed with one purpose, to stop Russia invading Central Europe. That doesn't involve storming many beaches, and so the Germans don't really have any amphibious landing capability of their own. Now, the German army is getting much more involved overseas. It's changing from being this force designed to defend against Russia to something that's much more expeditionary, something that's much quicker to get involved in hotspots all around Europe, North Africa, the Middle East. And so it's trying to develop these capacities. Meanwhile, the Dutch, they built this boat, but it was so expensive that they've not been able to afford to really use it properly. And so now you have this almost win-win situation. The Germans help the Dutch pay for it, and the Germans get an instant and dramatic expansion of their amphibious landing capabilities. And from the Dutch point of view, this kind of money constraint has been behind the whole thing. Their military spending has fallen from around 2.5% of their economic output to 1.2% of their economic output. So a dramatic, dramatic drop in their spending. And for their military commanders, the choice has been basically between getting rid of their tanks entirely or bringing their tank units into the German army. And having tank battalions commanded by Germans is at least better than having no tanks before. I mean, no tanks at all. And that's how the thinking goes. Now, just to go back to the deal that these two defense ministers made last February, the other part of this is that the German Sea Battalion, and that's about 800 soldiers of a naval protection force, mine-clearing divers, boarding soldiers, they will be absorbed into the Dutch Navy. They'll be under Dutch command. And then these two countries, they're going to have a German air defense unit join a Dutch unit. So it does go both ways, although they're exploring ways for that. So it does go both ways to a certain extent. But Germany is clearly the senior partner here. The Foreign Affairs magazine, they're one of the only English language news outlets that have had anything really to say about this. They quote Carlo Massala, a president of international relations at the University of the Bundeswehr. And this individual says the German-Dutch relationship works because it's one major player and one small player. So it's very clear who, again, is in charge, who is the senior partner here. And then there's something else to consider on this, that Germany's Constitutional Court has ruled that the German military can only be deployed with the permission of the Bundestag, with the German parliament. And this applies, the German Constitutional Court has made clear, this applies to German units stationed in other forces or part of multinational forces. And this is a subject that Mr. Ron Fraser wrote about some time ago. I don't have the title with me, unfortunately. But in any European military force, the German parliament is generally the only parliament in the EU that is legally obligated to approve any military mission. And as Mr. Fraser explained in some detail in this article, this effectively gives the German parliament veto power over the deployment of any EU forces. And the same is true here. Deutsche Presse Argentur wrote that in all previous collaborations, it was agreed that the troops' operations continued to be subject to checks by the national institutions and procedures. The Sea Battalion of the German Navy could thus be involved, for example, only after the approval of the Bundestag on a foreign deployment of the Dutch Navy. So even though the Sea Battalion is joining the Dutch Navy, it will be under Dutch command, they can't actually be used in combat without permission of the German Bundestag. And so that's the way it's going to go. And really, that it actually increases then the Netherlands' reliance on Germany and on Germany's permission. They'll the Sea Battalion will become part of the Dutch Navy. It'll be a unit that they rely on, and then they won't be able to use it unless they get the say-so from the German parliament. So effectively, they won't be able to do the kind of missions that they would want to use this for without permission from the German parliament. And it will really give the German parliament quite a large say over the entire operations of the Dutch Navy. Now, this cooperation, this goes way beyond just the Netherlands. Their cooperation is definitely the furthest advanced. But Germany has great ambitions for this. They're moving forward with similar arrangements with the Poles. They've swapped brigades there. There's a German brigade serving in the Polish army and vice versa, and they're looking at, and they've already begun naval cooperations, and they've talked about sharing some ships. And then the Czech Republic is really banging on Germany's door, trying to get in on this. Just like the Netherlands, the Czechs have two armoured brigades, and just like the Dutch, they want one of their armoured brigades to be absorbed into the German army, into the same 1st Panzer Division. And Hans-Peter Bartels, he's one of the senior politicians that's involved with planning and decision-making for the German army. He's very keen on this too, and he's really been promoting this and encouraging Germany to forge these kind of relations with other countries. And in fact, the German Defense Minister, Ursula von der Leyen, she says she wants to build a European army this way. Now, back in February, she said, "We will set up a multinational panzer division this year." And Die Welt wrote, "This should create a unit with up to 20,000 soldiers, which should be operational by 2021, which would be the nucleus of a European army." So the German defense minister is very publicly saying that she wants to build a European army centered around this German cooperation with other nations, with other nations giving these battalions to Germany, and then use that as the nucleus of a European army. And there's really no secret about this being the ultimate ambition. This idea, as it's been publicly stated at least, it goes back to von der Leyen's predecessor in the defense ministry, Thomas de Maizière, and at the Munich Security Conference back in 2013 and other speeches around this time. He basically made the case, look, we've been trying to create an EU army for years and years and years and years, and we've been trying to do it by having this kind of big piece of paper that all at once creates this European army from 25, 28 different nations and have it come into being all at once. And he says, look, we've got nowhere with that. We don't have this European army yet. So we're going to try and do it a different way. Instead of trying to get 20 or so nations to all agree to form one army, let's work at this one at a time. We'll work together with one country, we'll get some good cooperation with them going, integrate our armies together really closely, and then we'll start forming those deals with other nations, these other bilateral deals. And so we'll start bringing other nations into this relationship. So we'll get a German-Netherlands relationship going, then a German-Poland relationship, a German-Czech Republic. And then once, he was saying, essentially, once we've got enough of these kind of actual concrete cooperation going, rather than just this theoretical idea of a European army, once we've got these concrete cooperation, it will be much easier then to transition into a European army and to use all of that cooperation just as the building block of a European army. And that's exactly what Germany has been working hard at since then. And this is a trend that we've been right on top of right from the start at thetrumpet.com. And as I was putting some of this material together, I was looking over an article that we wrote back in 2013, right when this idea was first being put forward. And as we were talking about these early stages of Dutch-German cooperation, we wrote, "The Dutch have crossed the Rubicon and handed over control of a vital part of their armed forces to Germany. Will it stop there?" No, it certainly hasn't stopped. And we said, again, in that same article, I don't think I have that quote in front of me right now, but we said that they were going to get other nations involved in this, that we would see similar levels of cooperation. And again, we're seeing that happen. And at every stage of this cooperation, von der Leyen has talked about how she sees this as a model for building a European army. In 2014, when the 11th Air Mobile Brigade joined the German army, she said, "Our new partnership can be seen as a model for Europe and its common security and defence policy." In February, she called their cooperation a prime example for the building of a European defence union. And then just last Friday, Lieutenant General Dietrich Bonhoeffer, he was giving a speech where he held up the Dutch-German military partnership as a model for deeper integration between all European armies. And the German press sees this too. "Laboratory for an EU Army" was Die Welt's title for an article on this subject. And they had another article called "How von der Leyen is Driving the European Army." And they wrote here, "Von der Leyen and Mrs. Hennis Plasschaert, that's the Dutch defence minister, were playing the role of pioneers on their way to an EU army in Amsterdam." And what I think is really quite revealing about this is it's very clearly Germany that is in the driver's seat here. You know, you don't see British generals and politicians talking about forming these close defence relationships with other countries and building a European army. You don't see it from Spain, from France, from Italy, or any other of the EU's big powers. It's Germany that's working with the Netherlands, that's working with Poland, that's looking at working with the Czech Republic. They've also talked about working with Austria on this. And that in itself is very revealing. There has been quite a bit of talk recently about Germany as Europe's economic leader, Europe's economic power. But they quite clearly have ambitions to be the military leader too. In a lot of ways, it would be more logical for France to take the lead in this. In the kind of post-war era, they've been the big continental military power. But no, it's Germany. And then if this cooperation that Germany is initiating, if this forms the basis of a European army, if that's the foundation of a European army, well, who's going to be at the center of this European army? It will be Germany. It's built on and revolves around Germany. And now this is where I'd like to kind of come full circle and come back to the terrorist attacks that we started talking about at the beginning. The attacks in Belgium gave this whole initiative a huge shot, and then the Paris attacks before then, they gave this whole initiative a huge shot in the arm. If Europe wants to ramp up its ability to get involved in the Middle East, to try and go down there and take on ISIS, to stop these attacks at the source, then this is one of the quickest ways that it could do that. Spiegel talks about this in their article that they published in February on this Dutch-German merger, and they talk about how EU nations have slashed their military budgets just the way that the Netherlands have. And in order to confront the threat posed by Islamic State and by Russia, they talk about how Europe needs to increase its military capabilities again, and the best way that it says to do this is to coordinate more of this between European states. The Ministry of Defence sees it as a significant decision that France formally asked the EU partners for military assistance after the terrorist attack of last November, but not on the basis of Article 5 of the NATO Treaty, but rather on Article 42 of the EU Treaty. This, as it is said in ministerial circles, shows that a yet unexploited potential lies within the EU treaties. That's what Spiegel wrote right towards the end of this article on Dutch-German military cooperation. So this, and this is something we talked about on this radio program, on the trumpet, Mr. Gerald Flurry talked about this on the Key of David program after those Paris attacks. France didn't turn to NATO that included America for help. It turned to Europe and initiated for the first time Article 42 of the EU Treaty, which is this self-defense clause for the European Union. And so according to this, this had quite a big effect on the German defense ministry. And that's making them get more urgent about developing a European military capability and looking for ways to push that along. And so these attacks in Belgium that were attacks directly on European Union, or well, not quite directly, I guess, but almost directly on European Union institutions, an attack on the effective capital of Europe, is going to further push that in the same direction, to push people to think more about an EU army. And this German way of doing things, and of the German project that they've got started of absorbing these different nations' militaries into the German army, is the quickest, the most viable way of building that army. And so this certainly could lead to something resembling an EU army, or at least EU nations fighting together very closely coordinated, and hence a dramatic increase in Europe's military power and potential. It could lead to that pretty quickly, very quickly. And this military force is something that we've been warning about at the trumpet, Mr. Armstrong was warning about, at the plain truth, for a long time. Here's how Mr. Armstrong summarized what he'd been warning on the subjects back in 1983. He wrote, "The very first issue of the Plain Truth magazine appeared in February 1934, just 50 years ago, lacking about 6 months." Sorry, I think I said this was February 1963. I think it was a bit later than that, but 1983. The article stated on the cover, starting on the cover page, warned of a coming sudden appearance of a resurrected Holy Roman Empire in Europe, a union of 10 nations in Europe under one government with one united military force. Yeah, I'll just read that again. With one united military force. "For 50 years, I've been crying out to the world that the Bible prophesies of this coming United States of Europe, a new united superpower, perhaps more powerful than either the Soviet Union or the United States." In 1978, he wrote, "Europeans want their own united military power. They know that a political union of Europe would produce a third major world power as strong as either the United States or the USSR, possibly stronger." And here's just a couple of very short clips from a sermon Mr. Armstrong gave back in 1982, where you can hear him just very briefly talking about some of the same things.
"I have known for years, and you've heard me proclaim again and again and again, that the United States of Europe is coming. They're going to unite 10 nations in Europe. But what they want is political union. What they want is one military force. What they want is one great world power."
As he said, this was a very, very important prophecy. This was something that Mr. Armstrong talked about again and again and again. And this is what we're seeing the start of now in Europe. And Mr. Armstrong also said all along that Germany would be at the heart of this European political and military power. And he said that back in 1945, even. Now, if you were just analyzing world events from a historical perspective or geopolitics, you might have concluded that France would be at the heart of this military initiative to unite Germany. I think France would probably be the most logical one. After all, 1945, Germany was in ruins. But again, now we see that it is Germany in the driving seat, looking to build this European army, just as Mr. Armstrong said. And Germany's made more practical progress towards this military union in the last 3 or 4 years than the EU has for decades. And the rest of this army, now that they've got such a close relationship going with the Netherlands, now that they've proved that it can be done, now that they've overcome some of the obstacles, they've started to figure out, okay, what problems are involved in uniting this way. Now that they've solved a lot of those, the rest of this army could fall in place very quickly. Now, the Bible in Revelation 13 and 17, it talks about a beast power, a power made up of 10 kings or 10 kingdoms. So that's plainly an empire or a powerful conglomeration of nations. And Revelation chapter 17 and verse 13 says that these 10 kings have one mind and shall give their power and strength unto the beast, to this united power, to this, or at least semi-united power, to this union of 10 kings. They'll give their power and their strength unto the beast. And we're seeing the beginnings of that in the Netherlands. One nation is giving their power and their strength over to another. Two of their three battalions in the German army. The presence now of those German soldiers within the Dutch Navy give the German Parliament a great say now on how the Dutch Navy is going to be used. Now, I don't know if the Netherlands will be one of those 10 kings. We just don't know that yet. But we are seeing that in principle, one nation handing over its power and strength to another. And Germany, you know, taking this on as, and talking about this as being a template that it wants to put in place with other nations. And they're working on doing that already. And the Paris attacks in November and now the Brussels attacks, they're only going to accelerate this. And this is one of the key prophecies that leads up to the return of Jesus Christ, that the Bible clearly talks about in Revelation, in other books of the Bible, as being one of the key milestones to that event. And it's well on its way now to being fulfilled. There's so much of that united military, that united European power, that it's already there. Even though we can't quite see who those 10 kings are going to be yet, who the lead, or and how, just exactly how it's going to be structured. So much of it is already there, though. So much of the work has already been done. And that 10-nation military power could be built very quickly. But the good news from this, that we always need to emphasize, is that this also just shows that Christ will soon be here. And when he is here, he'll never allow any terrorist attacks, like we saw in Brussels, like we've seen in Paris, any of these attacks ever again. That's about it from me today. If you want more discussion on the Brussels attacks and some of the implications of that, along with more fascinating insight and analysis about your world, stick around for Trumpet Hour next. The Trumpet Daily Show will be back tomorrow on kpcg.fm, 101.3 on the FM dial. I believe Mr. Flurry will be back in the hot seat then. But until then, thank you for listening, and please tune in again tomorrow on kpcg.fm.